No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Tonight we have a very special guest. We have the president of the National Organization of Women, Christian Nunez. Ms. Nunez has an MBA and an MS degree. She's a licensed social worker. And she became the president of NOW in August 2020. She's the second African-American president in the organization's history and the youngest person of color and the youngest president in more than 40 years. Yay, because we need, you know, us old people need young people involved in the progressive movement. So welcome to our show, Madam President, and thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show tonight.
Well, you know, let's start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's a new law in Texas that came before the Supreme Court, and in a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court decided not to block this incredibly restrictive law, which actually turns – I mean, the most amazing thing about it to me is it turns citizens into vigilantes. So let's talk about that for a minute. I'm sure you have a lot to say.
I mean, so much. I don't even know if your hour-long show could really, truly just be just for this corporal vigilante law that was passed in Texas. I think the most alarming thing about it was the fact that Ms. SCOTUS, you know, voted 5-4 to refuse to block the ban, considering that it is unconstitutional what happened. You know, this is pretty much an overturn of Roe versus Wade, which basically guaranteed the right for pregnant women to be protected and have the free liberty to choose to have an abortion without excessive an interference, you know, from government. And so for Texas to first, you know, even pass this and then let it go through their Supreme Court and then come to the fact that, you know, our U.S. Supreme Court refuses to even block this ban, such a restrictive, you know, a law that says, you know, at 6 weeks, you know, pregnant persons, you know, are going to be held a criminal if they choose to get an abortion when most people aren't even aware they're pregnant at 6 weeks. And then on top of that, we're going to allow citizens to act as vigilantes to enforce the law and sue anyone involved in the process. And then reward them, you know, on top of that, if they can hunt out people and profile people who they think are seeking abortion. I mean, this is just setting a horrible precedent for violence, for profiling, and we know they're going to absolutely be targeting BIPOC, marginalized communities in this process. So it's just a really concern for what we're seeing happening for the rights of reproductive care and just access to abortion in general.
Well, you know, we've seen already that they've set up somebody set up a whistleblower website already. And so let me ask you, is this because of Roe v. Wade? Because I really don't understand how you can, you know, given Roe v. Wade, how you can do this. Is this just a tactic that will be ultimately overturned, in your opinion, by the Supreme Court? And in the meanwhile, it just opens the door for many more lawsuits like this, or many more laws like this, and it just, it's really just to start a fight. Is that what it's about? I mean, because ultimately, it can't stand up to Roe v. Wade, can it?
Well, I mean, what's kind of makes you wonder, because there's been an attack on Roe v. Wade for quite a while, and we've been seeing it happen in Mississippi, right, with the Mississippi 15-week ban, and that case is going to be held in Supreme Court in October. It's a hearing happening for that one. So many states that already have a very similar laws that they've been trying to push forth on, you know, reproductive care, access to abortion, abortion bans. They're very similar to this, but just not as restrictive and not as just vigilante and so extreme as this Texas law. And so, you know, these rights to, whether it be for, you know, the Hyde Amendment, whether it, you know, was trying to make sure we're not providing abortion care in federal funding, or whether it be just cutting federal funds to like clinics like Planned Parenthood and, you know, family planning clinics. We've seen a constant attack on any type of service where there is abortion care providers. So I think this is not just about abortion care. I think it's about power and control. I think it's about a war on women. I think it's about oppressing and continuing to oppress and control the autonomy of women. And Roe versus Wade is the one tactic that I think everyone is trying to use to do so.
Hmm. Maria, do you have a question?
I do. One, what I'm afraid of is that I've heard, in fact, there was a professor and a legal expert out of Florida, a woman who, her focus is Roe v. Wade, basically, and she said it portends terribly, this Texas law, that she's afraid that it's the beginning of the chipping, or maybe the continued chipping of the law. And, you know, as a single mother of four children and a practicing Roman Catholic and a Republican, I might add, I am all for choice. And to think that I am alive to have this conversation, that this might, I have a girlfriend, she's 74 years old. She had an abortion before it was legal. What she had to go through, and fortunately she came from some privilege in terms of her parents, and they were able to, but the dark alleys and all of that, and being left off at the curb and sneaking through the secrecy and the cloak of darkness, she's lived it. And to think that we might have to go back to that is just terrifying to me.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's also, it's a place where we have to think about too what these laws are doing for those who have been victims of, you know, it's a traumatic thing. I think we're putting these women through, right? The fact that they have to fear despair and having to go back into those places of in order of secrecy and shame that we're putting on people, instead of having the autonomy and the free agency to make your choices for yourself, that we're putting them back into a place of feeling shameful and secrecy about governing over their own bodies, which everyone has the right to do, and everyone, it's your basic right to be in control of yourself, but we're making them feel shameful about it, and we're putting shame on that. And not to mention as well, like, this law doesn't make allowances for incest or rape victims as well. So essentially, you know, we are basically making harsher crimes and harsher punishment for someone seeking abortion from a pregnancy resulting in a rape or incest than someone who perpetrates the rape. And that's what we're not even taking consideration. So, you know, it's we have to think about who are writing these laws and how do we see that a woman who's choosing, you know, and there's already trauma in that, right? The trauma and incest, trauma and rape. And we're saying, okay, well, we're going to hold you at harsher penalty. And someone who's trying to protect you and take care of you and create safe space for you and give you guidance and counseling at harsher penalty and punishment than the actual perpetrator of a crime. And that's on children and adolescents and minors, you know, and young and persons as well. And we have to look at ourselves and think about, like, what are we saying about our value system? And how can we as a country and society place blame on any other country and say how they treat their women globally when this is what we're doing to our women and girls in this country right now?
Let me ask you, as far as governors go in the process. Okay, we've seen this become such a controversial issue. I mean, I think it's been a controversial issue ever since before Roe v. Wade. But recently, we've seen Governor Beshear, for example, who's a Democrat in Kentucky, and Governor Hogan, who's a Republican governor in Maryland, step away from rules that restrict abortion. In other words, they didn't veto them, but they ignored them and they allowed them to become law because they're so controversial. And we've seen my former colleague, Terry McAuliffe, who's running for governor of Virginia, has made an issue out of this. And Glenn Youngkin, the Republican that's running against him, was caught on tape saying, yeah, I'm against abortion, but I'm not going to say it, really, because I don't want to turn people off. Is that a problem? Do we have to do something to instill in these people some courage to stand up for this issue?
I believe so. I mean, I think that, you know, as an elected official, you know, you are acting for what your constituents are electing you for, and you have an obligation to make sure that you're representing your elected officials. And one of the things I think we keep neglecting to think about is reproductive care as universal health care right. So in that, we don't get to pick and choose what we feel we want to include or exclude as reproductive care as universal health care right. So we want to say, okay, well, reproductive care, I want to include OBGYNs, well, reproductive care, gynecological services, but only if it includes this, but not this. Or we will include, you know, giving out free condoms, but we won't include this. Like, we can't, you know, we're inflicting too much of our value system on what we want to include in reproductive care, what we'll cover, but our values are letting us decide because we're too worried about, you know, we're practicing our party affiliation over our commitment to our constituents. And this needs to change because we have to take a stance. You know, we are affecting people's livelihood. And then it's affecting our economy and it's affecting our infrastructure. It's affecting so many different things. And everyone's so worried about, you know, what one's going to say, but they're not as worried about their communities. And we need to get back to working for the people and less worried about how someone's vote's going to matter. Your vote is going to matter when it comes down to if your people feel like you stood up for them and whether you stood up for them or not. Because I know if my elected official decided to be quiet at a time where it's really important, I'm going to remember that at the next election. And so we need to start holding these elected officials accountable for their ability to be silent and bystanders in times we need them to be advocates.
Well, let me just add before you ask your question that it's as a politician, it's hard to do that. I understand that. But you're right. We have to do it. I remember standing in a polling place and trying to get people to vote for me and having a woman walk up to me and say, how do you feel about the right to life? And you knew when you answered the question, you were going to lose your vote. You know, kind of stuck in my throat for a second. You know, and of course, I said, I stand for a woman's right to choose. I'm sorry, Maria. Go ahead.
But I think to the bigger point that, like, somebody like Governor Hogan of Maryland, what he said this morning on Meet the Press was, I'm pro-life, but the people and the legislature voted in something that I disagreed with, but I didn't feel it was my responsibility to exercise my personal opinion. I wanted to abide by what the citizens of my state did. And I thought that was pretty grand.
Grand, but I can tell you that in political speech, that's, I don't want to touch the issue, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, you want to make a comment? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to me, I think when you look at overwhelmingly, most people are pro-choice. And so I question that response because most people are pro-choice. So when someone says that, I question, like, is that really because you're saying you don't want to inflict your personal values, or is it because of where you feel like that is going. And I don't know really where he was coming from, so I don't want to speak for him, but I'm just saying I do question that because, you know, majority of people are pro, if you took a poll, majority of people are pro-choice. And so I do question, I think that it is difficult. I do see the difficulty in standing up and saying that because it is a very controversial issue. But I also believe in times like this, when we are seeing, you know, unconstitutional laws being passed, it is a position where we do have to stand up and understand that sometimes it's not going to always be a popular decision.
Let me ask you, I also heard, Marie and I both watched Meet the Press this morning, I guess, Barbara Comstock, former Republican congresswoman from Virginia, say that she thinks this was a big mistake on the part of conservatives who, the anti-abortion people. Do you think she's right? Is this going to be a flashpoint to which I know that, that Now is already mailing about it, McAuliffe is talking about it. Is this going to be a flashpoint for women to stand up? And did they make a big mistake in pushing a law that's this egregious?
Well, I definitely know that lots of organizations or coalition partners are mobilizing and organizing around this. And, you know, when you are looking at the impact that this is going to have on so many communities, I think that this speaks volumes, and people are fired up, and they're ready to organize and get together and fight back against us. So I think this was this decision to go forth with this has really put has ignited some flames under some people to really do some work and organize around this and do whatever is possible to make sure that this is overturned.
Yeah, I know it's fired up my daughters. I actually got in a fight with one of my daughters about this a couple of weeks ago, and I said to her, and obviously I was wrong, I said, look, you have Roe v. Wade. There's no way the Supreme Court is going to support this. And she was like, no, Dad, you don't get it. You're an old guy, which is usually what she says to me. And she was right. I mean, I'm astonished by it. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
So I want to get into what we're talking about, politicians, and then saying something say unfavorable or like President Biden, who is a practicing Roman Catholic, who denounced the legislation in Texas. And then we've got the American bishops trying to decide whether or not to deny communion to politicians who are supportive of abortion rights. And then we have the Pope weighing in and say, don't do that. That is not a litmus test for what is Catholic. And his quote is, the communion is not the reward of saints, but the bread of sinners. So, I mean, talk about, you've got the highest person in the United States defending abortion rights. And then you have the Pope of the world, Roman Catholics, basically saying, let's not make this a litmus test for who's a good Catholic and who isn't.
Well, you know, it is very much, I think, rooted, and you correct me if I'm wrong, in our culture and in different cultures. You know, my wife, Ms. Nunez, calls me one of the great theoretical feminists of the world, that I believe that all women should be equal except for her and my two daughters. And you know, there's some truth to that, right? Those cultural things die really, really hard. I mean, you know, all my children have college educations. We put them all through college, the two girls and my son. But I am more protective of the girls. It's the way I try to be conscious of that. But, you know, there is this big cultural thing that hangs over all of our heads, how we were brought up. And what do you think the role of women is in that? You know, because I never had, I say this often, and sometimes women slap me around for it, that I never had a male teacher until I was in high school. If I'm a misogynist, a lot of it was created by the women that trained me, who bought into it as well. What do women have to do to overcome these cultural things, do you think?
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, because the reality of it is that, you know, our culture is built on truly, like, white male patriarchy, right? So, right. And everyone has bought into that. Like, no matter who you are, you've bought into that because that's kind of how we've been raised. So it's a challenge for all of us to challenge some of those systems that are unhealthy, that perpetuate bigotry, that perpetuate racism and supremacy, that perpetuate misogyny. We have to challenge, and we have to challenge ourselves to not continue to contribute to those belief systems and those value systems, right? And there's also we also have to understand that every woman is not a feminist and every man is not a misogynist, right? So we have to understand that as well. So it's a constant education practice for all of us to challenge ourselves and do our own assessment of our own selves first, and challenge our own beliefs and our own thinking to see what it is that we're practicing and believing that is contributing to a certain belief system that is harming or creating injustices or inequalities for the other person, the other gender, or other genders, I should say, so that we are making sure that we're dismantling those things, and also finding ways to dismantle oppressions that are happening to people. And that's why it's really important to kind of from an intersectional perspective to see how all these things intersect and intercross, right? So for me as a Black woman, you know, I have different experience, right? So I have experience of not only being Black, but also being a Black woman, and how those two things intersect for me, race and my gender. And the experience I've had growing up with those two things. I've experienced racism and also experiencing racism and sexism and experiencing that growing up in a predominantly white community, you know, and what that was like. And so I had to work through what I was being taught and experienced and then challenge those things for myself and then the message I was receiving at home about, you know, differently. And I think everyone has to work through those experiences for themselves. Just because we're taught something doesn't mean it's right. And so we have to, you know, essentially, like you're saying you have this protection of your daughters, but part of it's being a father, and that's fine. But also if it's holding them back and assuming that they're not entitled to the same free liberties as other women, then you have to work on challenging those things for your own self.
Yeah. You know, just to put this into a little perspective for people, because I want to move on to the Equal Rights Amendment in a minute. I just want to read to you from the latest piece of Now Direct Mail. I used to be a direct mail consultant to the National Organization of Women. I'm proud of that. And so I'm still on your mailing list. And awesome. And just so people that understand, before they started Now, which was started by, unbelievably, by a handful of women in 1966. This is some of what women face. They could be barred from holding jobs under laws that were called BFOQs, Bonafide Occupational Qualifications, they couldn't hold a job in certain places where they had to lift more than 35 pounds. I can tell you, Mrs. Brown could carry me out of a burning building. They were paid 59 cents on the dollar. There were only 11 women in Congress at the time, only two in the Senate. Abortion was illegal. It was illegal for a husband to rape his wife. In 1966, women started Now, and we see things very much change. I'm proud of the fact that when I got my master's degree, I did a study on women and work and religion. And one of the things I remember in the 1970s is that 75% of women were found in four professions. They were either secretaries, nurses, clerical workers, or domestic workers. Now they're found in all 158 professions that's listed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So women have come a very long way, but they still have a very long way to go, right? They make 82 cents on a dollar instead of 59 cents. But
that's just for white women, though.
That's just for white women.
Right. Well, good point. Good clarification. Do you have the numbers for Black and Hispanic?
Sure. So Black women make 62 cents on the dollar, and I believe Latinx women make, I believe it's 57 cents on the dollar.
I remember it being terribly disparate.
Incredible.
And indigenous women, I believe, make 55 cents. It's pretty drastically low. And so I think it's just really important to, that we understand, once again, the intersex of gender and race and how they play into it. So when we talk about the 82 cents, it's for the white woman's earning on the white man's dollar, not even straight across for all women.
Well, let me ask you, have we learned? You know, one thing that always bothered me when I dealt with people in the women's movement and I was in college working on the ERA is why there wasn't more emphasis on how this affected men. You know, if your wife is making, if you're a Native American and your wife is making 55 cents on the dollar, that's 45 cents on the dollar that you're being cheated out of as well. And, you know, there was some criticism of the movement in those days. This was long ago, but they did a series of commercials with people like Alan Alda and Jane Fonda saying support ERA. And one of the criticisms of that was that anybody that listened to Alan Alda or Jane Fonda was already in support of the ERA. Meanwhile, this little housewife, and we all laughed at her. I know this is a little before your time, but we all laughed at Phyllis Schlafly. But she put up a woman general on her commercials who said, look, I'm a woman, I've made it in a man's world, and if you pass this amendment, all your daughters are going to have to go into combat, which we all understand is not true, but it really sold. Have we learned from that? Has the women's movement tried to bring more men in and show men how they suffer from the fact that women are held down?
Well, you know, I think it's one thing that's great is that there are a lot more male allies in the women's movement, and a lot more allies are men who consider themselves feminists, which I think is really helpful and with this movement. But I think overall, one of the problems with why I believe that happens, why the ERA has not been fully ratified, is that a lot of people believe that it's already in the Constitution. And even though we keep making this argument that it's not in the Constitution, that it's supposed to be ratified, the deadlines have been removed, you know, people say, well, why are you making this argument? It doesn't really affect you. Well, yes, it does. You know, like it is huge to not be included equal in the Constitution. It is huge that we are not protecting the Constitution. This is a major thing. You know, it is like we have, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris, the highest ranking woman in United States of America, who's fully protected on the White House. If she steps off the White House, what protections does she have? Because she's not in the Constitution, because women are not represented in the Constitution.
Well, you know, we're very proud of Kamala Harris, but she's a statehood supporter, by the way, so I'm particularly proud of her. But, you know, she is the vice president, and most industrialized countries in the world have had women presidents.
Yes.
We're still, you know, we still lag behind. And before I let Maria ask the question, just so our audience understands, this is the Equal Rights Amendment. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. It's pretty simple and straightforward. And I don't get where now, since it's been ratified by Virginia in 2020, and it's now got enough states to become a constitutional amendment, why we're still fighting this. It's just crazy to me.
It is.
Go ahead, Maria. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So President Nunez, being younger than both the senator and I would imagine it makes you apoplectic too, that we're still having these conversations, because I'm so done with it, and I can't believe that it is still something that we have to talk about, like the Equal Rights Amendment, like equal pay for equal work, like disadvantaged people not having the same advantages, and especially women of color, say, or sexual orientation, and all of those things that hold women back. Now, I know that ending violence against women is a big pillar of what the National Organization of Women stands for. Do you see some progress in that regard? I'm old enough that when I played basketball, there used to be six girls on a team, four of whom could not go full court because we were girls. I remember when my mother went to rent a power tool and she was denied because the insurance policy for the equipment rental didn't cover women and power tools. I've lived long enough to know these things firsthand, and the fact that we're not really that much closer is very troubling to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Maria, I completely agree with you, because if we think about, you know, what we're seeing is the fact that we've been fighting for this for, you know,
like half a century. 90,
yeah, 98 years, you know, right? Since yeah. Alice Paul introduced you, right, in Seneca. So I think we have to really look at, like, what is the problem? Why are we still, you know, with the House just being a bipartisan support with senators and, you know, and we're still fighting to finally have these deadlines removed so that we can have this added, you know, this full protection put in the Constitution. It is concerning, what the advancements women have made, the contributions women have made into this country, the fact that we are still fighting to be protected. And I think the other part of it is, like you said, like, there are lots of ways that this is harmful to women by not being included in the Constitution. And I think that there are examples that sometimes people don't recognize. And, you know, one example is, you know, there's a Massachusetts law that allows convicted rapists who impregnate their victims to seek custody and visitation rights to the child through the family court system. And without the ERA and without the strict scrutiny that comes with it, what comes with the Equal Rights Amendment, the woman's right to cut all ties from her rapist is less important than the government's interest in, you know, making sure the rapist pays child support. So these are reasons why ERA is important, right? And in other cases where, you know, the fight for against birth control, health insurance coverage is based on religious grounds in some places. And in cases where are constitutionally protected categories, you know, it's important that the court must apply what's known as strict scrutiny so to judge whether or not the law is constitutional. And law can only stand if there's a good reason for the law, and there is no other less restrictive or imposing way for the government to accomplish it than cite the aim of strict scrutiny. The constitutional quality gives that right. And so we have to look at all these things, why we have to have the ERA. It protects and provides provisions for, you know, women, and makes sure that we have equal treatment as the same as men. Gender, you know, no discrimination for work in the wage gap and pregnancy at work. You know, all these protections are reasons why we need constitutional equality. So for me, it's the same thing. It's like when I look at it, I'm like, why are we still fighting for it? These are things that should be logical, make sense for everyone mm-hmm. to understand why women need these protections. It's not rocket science to me, you know?
Yeah, me either. And just to bring up a more recent example, my wife was a professor at a Catholic university, part-time, in the summers, and she received a notice from them that if she was covered by their health insurance, which she wasn't, that because they were a Catholic institution, they refused to pay for certain things mm-hmm. like birth yep. control and other things, you know, and I guess they can get away with that because yep. Women aren't protected in the Constitution. Let me ask you, this is more personal, on a more personal level. I got the great honor on the 58th anniversary of the March on Washington to speak at the Lincoln Memorial, and I believe you did too. What did you have to say to women on that occasion?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I was going to speak. I didn't get a chance. I was sick with my sixth son, but my vice president did speak, and got a chance to speak there for us. But, you know, I know that it was an important, you know, time for us. And, you know, it was just such a great day if we, like, reflect on what's been happening, you know. And we look at the march in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And now we're, you know, I look at what's happened over the years. And that was back then, 250,000 people gathered there. The, you know, to peacefully protest for equality and justice. And I think when we look back at what they're protesting for, you know, I look at where we're at right now and what we're fighting for right now for the March on Voting Rights. And we're fighting again for voter suppression bills, against voter suppression in our marginalized communities. But I think the beautiful thing that we're seeing now is the solidarity within so many communities and how we're all coming together to fight against these things, you know, and to fight for, you know, free and fair elections, to fight for, you know, our freedom to vote and insurance the passage of the John, you know, R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And I just believe that we are really all going to come together to make sure that there are free and fair elections without violence, without racial profiling. And we are all committed to this cause, and we're going to make sure that these laws get passed. So I'm extremely hopeful about the Senate passing H.R. 4. Which will be S4, but I just believe that we must continue to create political will and political power and use collective power of the people to advance voting rights for all. And we have to continue to speak out whenever we can and to make sure that we're continuing making sure people's civil rights are being upheld for all groups of people, regardless of their race, their religion, their sex, you know, their gender identity. And I think that's kind of our role and our commitment to all of the great civil rights advocates and activists who fought for this dream that happened, you know, 58 years ago.
Could you let our listeners know, I'm real interested about the Unlock the Future campaign as well as the 100 Days of the Feminist Agenda campaign. Can you let our listeners know about that and how they might be able to get involved?
Sure. So the Unlock the Future campaign was a campaign that I spearheaded in 2019, and it was actually regarding the Trump administration's family separation bans that he started that separated immigrant families in the detention camps. So that was really geared toward making sure that we were standing up against that and fighting for a humane treatment for the women and children that were separated, making sure that they were having all the care, health care they needed, reproductive care they needed, and they were getting humane treatment. And we were really promoting the humane treatment for them, as well as the Immigrant Dignity Act, I think it's the Detained Dignity Act bill, and we did some rallies and protested and just made sure that we were really speaking out against how they were being treated and detained. Because if we went to a couple different detention centers and different tours of some border angels and things like that. So that's what that campaign about is really calling attention to the immigration reform system for comprehensive immigration reform. We've done some town halls this year. We'll have another town hall coming up in October. And we'll continue to do some rallies coming up in 2022 at some more town halls. And as we're continuing to call for comprehensive immigration reform and creating a safe space for those who are going through the process to make sure that they are being treated and their amendments are being protected according to what the amendments say, and there is dignity in how they're being treated, why they are here seeking asylum, asylum status and refugee status as well. So there's lots involved in that.
It was like, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and then the 100 days of feminist agenda was aligned with the Biden-Harris administration, 100 days in office. And that was a series of different panel town halls we did, which placed spoke to our six core issues of now, and it was aligned in a couple other issues. One that started off with COVID, and we really talked about it from the BIPOC experience, because a lot of times you never really amplified and lifted up the voices of the BIPOC community and the Latinx community. So we wanted to make sure we amplified their voices and told their narratives of how they've experienced these different issues. So we brought in experts and panelists and to tell from the perspective of their experience what these issues, as well as we spoke from a policy angle of what policies and resources we need to make sure we're advocating and providing effective services in the communities for these individuals. This is a really effective series we did. We'll be doing another series come toward the end of fall, beginning of beginning of winter, not end of fall. So beginning of winter, we'll start another series again. But essentially what we do is we bring in and touch different topics, bring in different speakers, panelists, experts, academics, activists, a mixture of different artists, and blend the speakers to really talk about these important issues and use it from a legislative perspective as well as the activist perspective. We blend both in a narrative of those who actually experience it firsthand.
Mm. Well, let me ask you if about next steps, excuse me, with the Texas law being so aggressive, and now, you know, I'm certainly hearing in the press that there are several other states that are considering the same type of legislation and are being so, they're being so aggressive with this stuff. Do we need to be just as aggressive on the progressive side? I know that Nancy Pelosi, for example, another former colleague of mine from the DNC, wants to pass a federal law guaranteeing abortion. There's also calls for the Biden administration to change the court. In other words, expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court. Do we need to do things like that? Do we need to, even if they don't come to pass, do we need to push for things like that? I'm from North New Jersey originally, and we're definitely fight fire with fire people. So is that the kind of thing we need to do?
I believe so. I think we need to expand the court, get rid of the filibuster. We definitely need to push forth those type of laws, you know, like, you know, making abortion a guaranteed right for all. I think those are necessary progressive laws that have to happen. But definitely getting rid of the filibuster has to happen, because as long as the filibuster is taking place, they're just going to go to the Senate graveyard like the other 400 really progressive, you know, bills that have been sitting there that are really there for the people. So we have to think about, you know, what we're doing that's preventing all these really progressive bills from even becoming enacted. So the filibuster is the main issue. So that has to go. And we definitely need to expand the court, because right now the court is favoring what we're seeing, what just happened. I mean, look what happened with Texas and SCOTUS. Right. So, I mean, we have to expand. We have to have this court more leveled and balanced, and right now it's not. So expanding the court will be extremely important, because how it's going to go right now, it'll be a while before the court ever becomes balanced. We don't expand it. It needs to be balanced, and expanding the courts will be an important part in doing that. We have to become a progressive. We have to have to level the playing field. Right now it's not. And so these are important things we have to do. And we need to push back. We need to get super ignited and recognize these people's lives that we're dealing with. This is the future we're dealing with. And America and our democracy is at stake. And as long as we continue, if we do not take that as, like, the seriousness of our democracy at stake, if we don't push back, then we might as well just be prepared for more things to come.
Yeah, and as far as the filibuster goes, from your lips to God's ear, you know, it's really what stands in the way of statehood for us in the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. Maria?
And it makes no sense. And D.C. should have had statehood.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead, Maria.
So, according to reputable sources in the media, starting with the New York Times, there apparently so far isn't any kind of backlash with others about what happened in Texas. Portland, Oregon is the only one that their city council said that they're going to consider banning products that were produced in Texas. But why do you suppose that is? Where the restrictive voting rights bill, earlier companies got involved like American Airlines and Dell Technologies in Texas, which are two of the biggest employers there. Why the silence on this, do you think, corporately?
You know, I've been hearing about this, the corporations who were supportive of this. And I, you know, part of me feels is that because of COVID, and this is part of me, and I feel like, you know, we're in such a crisis with COVID pandemic and so many jobs being lost, and people you're still in panic mode and still in crisis. So if they ban and there's restriction on, they stop working for them, they stop using those products, then it starts affecting jobs for people. And I think there's still fear, right, because they're still trying to recover from job loss. We still have over 11 million people without homes and evictions, right? I think people are still fearful to do that. People are still trying to recover. And so I think that's part of it, honestly, and no one's going to talk about that. And then I think the other part of it is just the corporation side and the greed side, right, who don't want to lose their money, and so they're not going to do anything to affect their dollar bill. So I think it's two
Except
sides of the coin.
We had the murder of George Floyd during COVID, and that still galvanized people. I mean, they're saying two dozen major companies in Texas refused to comment, and including AT&T, Oracle, Phillips 66, Patagonia, Levi's, the companies who are known for their diversity and inclusion and equity stances, aren't taking a stand on this, and I don't get that.
I don't really have an answer. I mean, I don't understand it at all either. But I will say that, you know, the war on women has been an ongoing war, and it's a severe war. I remember there was this comment Shirley Chisholm stated when she was running for president, and she's a black, you know, she's the first black woman to run for president in the 70s. And she made a comment about feeling that sexism was, you know, the experience of sexism was the most more extreme for her than her experience of just being a black woman and just being black sometimes. And I think that speaks volumes sometimes, that sometimes the experience women have on just the people's decision to want to control women and women's bodies, whether people want to acknowledge that or not, I think is so deeply rooted that they are willing sometimes to be quiet about it because people have so many deeply rooted values about a woman's place that they don't even recognize it. And so sometimes people are so willing to be quiet about it that I think that's sometimes why we hear silence when these types of
things. And I should say that Uber and Lyft did come out this week and say that they will reimburse any employee that gets sued or reported on that delivered somebody to get an abortion. So those are two companies that have said something about it.
Well, I'm happy to hear about that. That website that reported that for people to report abortions was taken down. So that is one positive thing that did come out of it.
Right. Well, let me say, you know, it just to add to what you said, Ms. Nunes, it is a real conundrum for us. You know, you mentioned President Trump, for example. If there's ever been a misogynist in the White House, I think it was President Trump. And look how many women voted for him. My mother was a Republican. My mother was a Republican organizer. And after he made those comments about women to Billy Bush, the Lord could have come down and told her to vote for him and she wouldn't have done it. You know, I mean, I was so convinced. So the one positive thing I can say about that election is that everybody in my family asked my opinion about it. And I said, there's not a chance in hell that this guy could get elected. There's no way that's ever going to happen. Now they no longer ask me for my political opinion. But it really shocked me. And it shocked me because, and what I was shocked about more than anything was women. Because women vote more than men. They make up the largest part of the electorate. And not only did they, many of them stay home, but many of them voted for him. And I just don't get it. So what do we have to do to work on women as well as men? Is there some special things we need to do to say to women, you're shooting yourself in the foot when you support people like this?
Well, I think we definitely have to continue to work on helping and educating women about how certain policies, how certain laws will affect them, and how it affects their family, and how it affects them in different areas. you know, a lot of women voted for Trump because they believed in his economic views and you know, and how they felt it in certain value systems he had. And that's why I heard a lot of women voted for him, right, and certain viewpoints he had. They didn't think about all that other stuff. So the ones, so the viewpoints they felt were priorities is why they voted for him, and they disregarded all other things. That's a problem, right? So we have to get people to understand is that you have to look at the whole picture of the person you're elected. You can't choose to compartmentalize when you're electing someone. You can't say, well, this one economic principle policy he has, platform is good, but the other 15 he has are misogynist, racist, you know, violent, you know, and just, you know, you can't overlook all those. You have to look at everything. But I think we have to just continue to work with, you know, we have to continue working in our organizations and our groups and with our allies to continue to educate on why it's important. On some policies that were in these in our progressive sides, and even if they're not progressive, it's why certain policies are important and how they impact us as a whole community. And I think that's the way we have to go about it. We have to continue to educate.
Well, we're starting to run out of time here. So first, let me say that if you're a woman listener out there, you should support, actually everybody should support this organization, and you can do it very simply by going to now.org, N-O-W.org. You know, support them, sign the petitions that they put out, give them money because they work on behalf of all the women in America. But let me ask you, before we let you go, Ms. Nunes, because we're running out of time, is there anything you want to say that we haven't asked you?
I think, like you said, we want to continue support. I want to encourage everyone to call your Congress members. You know, we are seeing a lot of action alerts lately. We want to encourage you to call regarding, you know, H.R. 4. We encourage you to call regarding, you know, every issue that affects you personally. We are mobilizing. Please join now. We have lots of programs that we have started to organize, train up organizers, train up activists to run for office, so that we can train the type of feminists that we want to lead in this world. And we just ask you to join our organization, get involved. We have state chapters, local chapters, and everywhere. But just make sure that you are choosing, you know, and advocating for causes that you feel passionate about that really speak to you. So we just encourage you to just get involved, call your Congress members, let them know how you feel about these laws that are being passed. And make your voice heard.
Maria, do you have a final word for Ms. Nunes?
I'm curious, President Nunes. The word feminist, to me, doesn't mean that you're anti-male. And Michael, as you said, I believe that you are a feminist. And just because you're protective of Mrs. Brown and your daughters doesn't mean that you're not. So I don't see... like when a man treats me like a gentleman, I don't see that as demeaning or degrading, but absolutely, I'm still a feminist.
Right. And
I don't know why that conversation can't exist jointly.
I mean, Marie, you bring up a great point. We have male members and men can be feminists, right? And I think it's
yes,
really important.
Absolutely.
Bring up. And I think, and that's why I said earlier, like every man's a misogynist, right? So I think it's important for people to understand that a feminist doesn't mean that you hate men at all. I have brothers. Right. I have a son. I have men in my life that I love. There is nothing wrong with men, right? And every man is not a misogynist or has toxic masculinity. What we're fighting against is systems of patriarchy, misogyny, and toxic masculinity that lead to violence, that lead to mistreatment of women and discrimination of women. Those are the things we're fighting against. Those things have to be corrected. Every man doesn't do those things. Every man doesn't contribute to those things.
And just because they're a man, they're not guilty.
Right,
like
right.
Some people
it's
think
about,
that
it's
feminists,
about a set of behaviors yeah. that we're challenging,
right.
not the person.
Right. Exactly.
So we're challenging behaviors. We're not challenging the group of men, right, who are challenging behaviors. Because also sometimes, as we talked about earlier, too, women can also contribute to the same behaviors because it's a system that we've been raised in. So we have to challenge the set of behaviors, and we have to encourage men to challenge those same set of behaviors in each other, because men are the best educators and the best challengers with each other. Men can challenge toxic masculinity in each other better than, you know, than a woman trying to challenge a man. And men can challenge misogyny in men better than, you know, and correct it in another man better than, you know, as good as men, and say that this is not okay. This is not, right. not acceptable. So it's behavior that we're challenging, and we want to continue to challenge behavior, because those behaviors create violence and inequality and oppression for women, and that's what we don't want. But being a feminist is not about hating men at all.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a great way to end the show, and thank you so much for being on. At the end of each show, we play a song to play us out. We dedicate this song usually to our guests. Tonight, we're playing a song by Rachel Platten called Fight Song, which I think says it all about empowering women. And I'd like to thank you. And I'd just like to add one more thing, just to be honest. My feminism does wane sometimes when it comes to cleaning up the dinner dishes and some of the other things that Mrs. Brown and the girls complain about. But my heart is with you, Ms. Nunes. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for all the great work you do. As this progresses and hopefully the court beats it down, we'll have you back again sometime.
Yeah,
thanks so much.
I'd be more than happy. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for all you do and continued success, please.
Thank you. You'll have a great evening. Thanks.
And to you. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.